You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. Summer is just around the corner. You can feel it in the air. That means we are getting outside. We're meeting up with friends, and we're probably going to have a drink or two. And so we thought, who better to talk to than legendary bartender Aaron Polsky, who's also the founder and CEO of Livewire, curated, highly quaffable canned cocktails. We talked to him about his time in New York, starting under Sasha Petrosky, and how his road to starting his own business took him right up to the start of COVID in March 2020. Then we dig deep into the archives for a dreamy 1950s pop performance from the Rizzos. Grab a sweetheart and a drink. It's going to be a great episode here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Aaron, good to see you. Thank you for making time to sit down with us for Snacky Tunes. I feel like I ran into you at the 101 event back in December, and I've seen you nonstop ever since.
I've been following you around.
We crossed paths back in the mid-aughts when you were behind the bar of some legendary cocktail spots because you had gotten to the cocktail scene, studying under Sasha. And what was it like being a part of that renaissance of the cocktail era and being at the epicenter in New York?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. You don't really know that you're at the epicenter at the time. Sure. Until you look back. It was really exciting. It was a really small community. There weren't that many bars doing what we were doing back then. I mean, it was literally probably like 20 tops in New York. But yeah, it was exciting. I mean, it's a totally different style of bartending, and everybody was still sort of figuring out what they were doing and figuring out how to transition from craft to volume. And the one that I worked at, the bar that I initially was behind was White Star. I was hosting at Milk and Honey, and Sasha opened a bar a couple blocks away on Essex called White Star. And it was honestly pretty frustrating for me when I was like a first, it was the first place that I had bartended. And like, you know, I saw my friends at PDT and Death & Co. and Milk and Honey, like all having the luxury of a seating only policy. Mm. Right. And White Star was a bar with that yeah. level of drink. Right. So it's like, it would be like those bars, those other bars never got one deep, two deep, four deep, any deep, right? Because it was like
the only depth to Death & Co. was the line outside.
Right, right. Whereas like White Star, it would just like get like three deep right away. And I had been bartending for like a month. And so it was like very stressful to be putting out, you know, because we focused on such quality and consistency.
Sure.
And like style of service, that it was, and the systems that we were taught in the sort of Milk and Honey school were intended to help you make cocktails efficiently, but like without the mental, muscle memory of just dealing with guests and like figuring out how to prioritize guests by like the order they came in at and how they ordered and like the multitasking, the sort of like octopus thing.
Yeah.
Without that, it was like pretty paralyzing, but it was like looking back at it, it was incredible. And like the bars that I worked at subsequently sort of rounded out my skill set so that I could do that. Right. Like after that, I worked at a couple of spots, but eventually went to, the Standard, right? The Boom Boom Room on top of the Standard. And like, there were reasonably complex cocktails there. But like, I've never been in the weeds since working at that place because it was like so insane.
Yeah.
That then I like came out of it and sorry, go ahead.
No. I mean, it, you know, I feel like you sort of fell into the mixology world while some other people sort of sought it out. And so maybe you had a different perspective of being like, this is great to learn, but I maybe have a different approach of how I want to serve people. And it's not just from the same, like everything needs to be this, I don't want to say formulaic, but like finding the balance between getting the drinks out, having a good time versus like a really great drink.
Yeah, I mean, I was always super interested in the world of cocktails. I basically, like, I was 18. I was working at Bouchon Bakery. The chef there, James McDuffie, who is now in charge of, well, last I spoke to him, he was in charge of, like, Fedora and all of those Gabe Stuhlman slots. Mm. He was like, there's this bar with a phone booth that you go through. And I was like, mm-hmm. What? Mm-hmm. And I went to PDT for the first time. So I was always super into it. And then Sasha opened a coffee shop called the Mercury Dime, which was two blocks from my apartment. And so I was going there for coffee pretty regularly. And one of the hostesses or one of the baristas there, Nicole, was a hostess of Milk and Honey. And she was like, hey, I need my shift covered. I already cleared you with Sasha. And I was like, what? And I just like covered a hosting shift. But it was always something that I was super interested in. So I like did kind of fall into it, but it was like something I very much wanted to do, you yeah. know? And like, yeah. just as my career moved along, it became clear that it was the right path for me. But, what you were saying about like finding that balance, you know, I think that what Sasha was doing with the cocktail style that he sort of pioneered, right? It was very much the baseline off of which everything we know now is built.
Yeah.
And I equate making those drinks and making a career out of making those drinks the same as being like a violinist at the New York Philharmonic, right? You're playing the music of dead people, right? Like all of the cocktails that we made were basically like cocktails from the 30s or cocktails from the 1860s and with variations thereof, but it was very much this very old style. And it's how perfect and beautiful can you make it? right? Like,
what's your sour? What's your julep? What's your martini? What's your Sazerac?
Right. Right. And it really focuses on like the last 1% of the process, right? Like, we can all put the ingredients together. We can all put them over ice and stir them. But then it's like, how cold is your ice? Did you crack it right? Did you stir it for, you know, the amount of time? People talk about like the right amount of time to stir a drink. And I kind of think that that's bullshit. Like, there's so many variables in it that it's almost more akin to, you know, how like in the morning a barista will pull a bunch of shots and adjust the grind, the fineness of the grind, like at the coffee shop based on like how hot it is outside and how humid it is and just what it's doing that day. That's more like, if you're getting into that minutia of drink making, that's what where I think it's at. And if you're like, oh, I need to stir this 17 times, you're like missing the mark. But anyway, that's that style.
You're like, but I think you shook it, pour it in the glass, slide it over the bar. You know, it's interesting. I know music has always been a big a part of who you are. And even hearing that, you know, analogy of a violin, is pretty core to your personality. I think everyone knows about your love for rock and roll. How did you incorporate that into your bartending? Because when I think about Death & Co. and I think about those places, I think of like jazz and like a little bit more of a different type of music and ethos that you were bringing to the cocktail scene at that time.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is like one of those you connect the dots backwards things. But when I worked at Amore Amargo, it was on my nights a one-person shift, right? Mm. And we had a little like iPod dock Bose speaker behind the bar, and that was the only place the music came out of. And we could just choose whatever we wanted to play. And I started doing like full album Mondays and live album Tuesdays, right? And I just played like the music I wanted to play. And when it was empty, like when we opened, I would like blast it so that people would hopefully come in off the street. Sure. But, you know, I just think that that like rock and roll vibe makes it fun. And, you know, whenever you're stuck for a drink name, song names are always really good.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least a jumping off point. Then it's like Stairway to Highball.
Sure. Yeah. I don't think anybody's done that.
It's a free one, man. Write
that
down.
Is that a Darren Bresnitz original? All right.
Cool. Yeah. Put me on the roster.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah. So it's, people connect to it. And, you know, when I bartend and like a song, and let's say it's like I haven't found my groove yet, or it's like kind of getting crazy and I'm like not really clicking. If a song that I really love comes on, especially if I like had nothing to do with it, it like clicks. You know, you sort of like, people talk about, you know, finding your flow with like when it's usually with like any skill, right? You like getting into the flow is when you're active mind shuts off and you sort of like the muscle memory clicks and you just do what you're good at. And that really helps, you know, and it's like, usually like if Night Train by Guns N' Roses comes on, I'm in.
Sure. Yeah.
So I think it affects your mental state. I think it affects guests' mental state. And, you know, you can even go deeper. There are those studies that show that like the music that you're listening to while you're eating certain foods changes the way the food tastes. Right. And so, I think there's lots of ways to go, but at the end of the day, rock and roll is fun. Rock and roll is like a lifestyle, and sort of just something that's always been, a part of who I am. And, you know, everything that I do, I just like try to imbue it a bit.
I mean, that's great. It's always fun finding those juxtapositions in food and then music, of just being like, okay, here's a great high-end cocktail, but sort of in a dive bar with like a rock and roll sound. I've always loved that two worlds coming together. I've been drawn to that. And I think part of why I've been drawn to that is that after, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years of the mixology scene in New York, people started to be like, there's got to be a different way to get a good drink or different things like that. And I felt like that shift was not just out of the city, but to the other coast. And I know that you got drawn out to LA, like a lot of us who worked in food and media and things like that. Did you have a similar feeling, or what brought you out to LA? You know, what made you feel that your time in New York had sort of reached its end?
Yeah. So I basically, one of my friends, my friend Michael Neff, he was working on the project out here, and he had teased it to me for like a couple of years while I was in New York. And he was like, "Hey, man, if you ever want a job in LA, like, you got one." I didn't know what it was. I was working for a pretty shitty place, my last place in New York.
That's usually how it goes. It's everyone's like, did I break up, or did I have a bad job, or did I lose my apartment and I don't want to move out to another borough? LA? Yeah. Question mark?
I guess. I mean, I basically, so like, you know, I've never been one for authority, but also I feel like I'm right a lot. So anyway, so I got fired.
Can we check that? Do you have a reference who would sign off on that opinion as well?
Nope. I don't know who you're talking about. So yeah, I got fired from this job for the third time in 8 months, which was like very dysfunctional, right? Where like you get canned and then the boss is like, "Hey, I need you on Friday night," right?
Oh,
like,
my God.
And I kind of went for a string
that
of
that. Sounds
those.
Like a classic New York relationship if I've ever heard one.
100%. Yeah, on and off again job. But anyway, so like I got fired. I was like, great. It was actually pretty funny without getting like spending too much time on it. The place had a patio like in the back. And so it was May, and you know, New York, right? If there's a patio, that place is like bombed immediately.
The second it's warm.
The second
even
it's warm.
Hit to warm, people are like, "Let's go. I just left work."
Yeah, I don't care what they serve. I don't care what it is. I need to sit outside.
Oh, cool. And shots something. And beers? Great. A dirty, you know, slushy machine that's got some booze in it?
I'll sign be there. Me
yeah.
up.
I'm on the six. I'll be right there.
So anyway, so I basically started my shift. It was like a Sunday afternoon. The place had just opened. And it like within 5 minutes fully filled up. And before service, I had sent a justified but snarky text to my boss. And so I'm like in there, got a full board of tickets. The place just opened. Full board of tickets and people at every single table. And the guy across the street who like owned the liquor license, like whatever, sketchy stuff. But he's like, he goes in there and he's like, "Hey, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the owner just told me to tell you you're fired. You got to go." And I was like, and I just looked down at the board and I look at all the tickets and I'm like, "Okay." And I just walked out.
There you go.
I don't know how long it took for those people to get drinks, but.
So you left the bar, went to JFK, got on a plane, landed at LAX. I've heard it. Tale as old as time.
Yeah. Yeah, then I had watched the Sonic Highways episode, that Foo Fighters show, on LA, and I was like, you know, after like a week or two, I like call up, and I was like, "This place looks cool." I had only been here once before, in 2011, for a couple of days, and I called up Mike Neff, and he told me about the gig, and I was like, it was Clifton's Cafeteria.
Shout out, like, great martinis, by the way, RIP.
It was like going to be a 5-level multi-concept nightlife spot. And so I was going to run the bar in the basement called Shadowbox. And it was supposed to be like this very immersive, futuristic, whatever spot. And so I moved out here to do it in 2015. And that's what got me out there.
Yeah. All right. Well, like, let's take a quick break. I want to get into a little bit of time in your LA, and then you're switching from being behind the bar to being behind the business of Livewire. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.org.
Well, did you ever want to be boy out on the sea, boy? All of your possessions below the deck. So when they question what South boy and know it's bad. Well, did you ever have a daydream that made you cry for a lovely lady to call her own? Then you ask that lady, does anyone really know me? Well, I know those. I've slept alone for most of my life. Well, do you want to know me, girl? I can see in your eyes a look of pity for the way I live. Well, I may not be striving, but I'm surviving. And I love the nighttime, and I can take that sunshine each morning before I lay down and go to bed. But all you know I like an exaggerator in my life, but in the well, don't you know, but everybody knows. Well, don't you know, oh, 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 oh. Well, she said, farewell, boy, you sleep too much there, and it's too cold up here.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are with Aaron Polsky, founder, CEO of Livewire. So you're in LA and you're working on different bars and projects and things like that. And you know, it's one thing to like make a bar program and run a successful bar. It's quite another thing to put them into a can and try and sell them as a product. When did you start thinking about a shift of how you were going to run, I don't know, your life, your business, who you are, from being behind the bar to making a brand out of cocktails?
Yeah. So the initial idea was like 2012. I actually started thinking about this.
Canned cocktails during that time were gross.
Not a thing in the US.
Not a thing. Well, I mean, the ones in Europe were like, you ever get a bottled spritz? Not great.
I have recently the new Aperol Spritzes. I think they're all right, but I didn't have
one. Not in 2012, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. I mean, a lot of companies really raised the bar on it.
Good pun.
Maybe Aperol was like, oh, maybe Aperol was like, hey, the slide bar is pretty good. We got to step up the game.
sitting on the Riviera being like, uh-oh, they're coming for us.
They're coming.
Step up the spritz game. So it's 2012.
This Jew from LA is coming for us.
Oh, man. Wrong decade for that Italian discussion. Anyway, so it's 2012.
Yeah, 2012. I just started getting some press for bartending. Talia Biocchi, I think, was actually the first person to write me up in this little Eater article. But then, like, got some stuff in Serious Eats, and I was like pretty stoked, like riding high. And I was like, this is really cool. And I was like, but it kind of doesn't make sense. These are national publications, and like people in other cities can't drink these drinks that people are writing about. Right. So, and I had majored in music business, at NYU, and you know, to me, like scaling intellectual property was sort of something I had studied and learned about and whatever. And I was like, you know, the consumers can't drink the drinks and the bartenders can't monetize their press. And like the press loves the bartenders, but like it's sort of, it doesn't benefit anybody except for really the bar owner. And like, sure, to some extent, you know, you get the press that leads to better jobs, that leads to some awards.
Maybe you get like a brand ambassador deal.
Right. Or like one-off gigs with a big brand, but like none of it really builds long-term equity. So, I started working on it then, and pitched it to a couple of liquor companies who just like could not wrap their heads around it. You know, they were like, this is cool. These taste great, but
like too early. To your point, it's just like, I don't understand what you mean. We're going to put a drink with booze in it. I mean, 2012. Well, I guess you'd already had like Sparks. I mean, you'd had malted beverage.
So there's an important distinction to draw here is our cocktails were spirit based, and right. still are. And what most people don't know is that the state tax rates in most states on spirit versus beer is about 20 times higher per ounce. So like this is a 7.5 ABV can of a gin cocktail, right? But it's a 12 ounce can, 7.5 ABV. We pay about, call it 50 cents a can in taxes on it, in state taxes, maybe 30 cents. A beer would be about a penny for a 7.5 ABV.
Wow.
Beer.
And that
same
adds
amount
up.
Of alcohol. That adds it up. Really adds up, right? So when I'm pitching, these huge liquor conglomerates who are used to their margins, right? They're like, I can't make this work given these taxes. That's like primarily the thing.
But can't you charge more for a spirit-based can than a beer-based can?
Yes, but like at the time and even now, I mean, ours sit at the top of the market.
Sure.
And there are inherent challenges to that. But, right, yeah, I mean, all RTDs cost more than beers, right? You go to Ralph's and you get like a premium microbrew beer or whatever, and you're not paying more than $2 a can on it, right? These you're paying at least four, but like for Livewire, most of our retailers sell them between $5 and $8 a can. So
you definitely can
charge more, right? But it's like, we're talking about 2012, 2014, 2015 when I'm pitching and like people are like, what are you doing?
So you're sitting on this idea, you're in LA. What finally starts to put it in motion for real?
Yeah. So I was like gearing up to leave Harvard and Stone in July of 2019. And I left and I basically decided like, I will finally make this a reality, right? I will finally make this canned cocktail company that I had a reality. So I left. I raised $47,000, which was enough essentially to form the company and do the first run of cans, which was like 8,000 cans of Heartbreaker. And those came off the production line on March 3rd of 2020.
What a date for things to come off.
Yeah, what a real treat. I was still optimistic at the time. I was like, oh yeah, this COVID thing, whatever,
well,
but it wasn't.
Well, you would think that people are at home. They can't go to a bar. They want a cocktail. And after maybe like 2-3 weeks of making your own cocktail at home, you're like, I need something else. But was that not the case?
Well, people wanted the familiar, right? People wanted a handle of Tito's or like a bottle of, you know,
Jameson, beer.
Jameson, you know, it's like they wanted stuff that they knew or stuff that they could, you know, that wasn't too far of a jump for them.
Could you describe the flavors and like the type of cocktails you make that go into the cans?
So what we do is we partner with award-winning bartenders to put their cocktails into cans, right? So we make signature cocktails. We don't do any – we're not trying to capture the market of generic cocktails. So we're not making just straight-up margaritas or Moscow mules or whatever. So the cocktail that I told you about, the Heartbreaker, is mine. And it is essentially it's like a mule with grapefruit, kumquat, and jasmine. So vodka based, but all those things, vodka, Oro Blanco, grapefruit, marumi, kumquats, ginger, and jasmine. Joey Bernardo's cocktail. Joey is over at Broken Shaker, LA. He's got the Honeydew Collins. It's gin, coconut, honeydew, lime leaf, and elderflower. So like, that's sort of the kind of thing that we're doing. Even like our old fashioned, my friend Chris Patino, who owns Raised by Wolves in San Diego, has an old fashioned with us, and it's, rye whiskey, apple brandy, and cherry bark vanilla bitters. So like, everything has its own sort of unique, angle. Because really what we're doing is like, we're bottling the bartender, right? We're like, really, that is the fan base that we're promoting and trying to build. But yeah, so.
So not exactly when people are looking for the comfort and familiar in the back half of March in 2020 or even April or June, people are like, just give me volume of what I know.
Right. I mean, it's like not even the brand that they knew, right? We were brand new. Like, we got good press, but that still didn't change. Like,
I feel like there were some other stories during that time that may have been trumping your own press. I can't think of anything that was going in March. I'm just trying to remember.
Yeah. I don't know.
So what did you do? Because, you know, it's so interesting because had you come out maybe in like 2021 and the story was like, I was a bartender, but I pivoted because of COVID. Like, this is the story. This is the journey. And people were like, oh, it's like a year into the pandemic. Like, this is exactly what I need right now. That is a different proposition than right a week, literally the week before everything shut down.
Yeah. You know, I basically, so March 3rd, we made the cans. March 5th, I went into the market and like just knocked down the wins, man. Like, seven accounts were like, yes, we want it. There was a freight delay getting our product to the distribution warehouse. And by that point, it was like March 22nd. And like, all of those stores that said, yes, we want it, were like, pump the brakes. Like, we got to figure out our shit. Like, give me some time. They eventually all picked us up. But I just hit it hard. Like, I went to around to stores and tried to pitch them on stuff. It was really hard to get meetings, a lot of like not in person, you know. I went down to San Diego, got a handful of account placements there. And like, I had friends pick it up. You know, and you really know who your friends are when you start a brand.
100%. It's like, everyone's down for a six pack. Everyone's down for a couple of cans. And then it's like, I need your shelf space. I need your time. I need your money. I need your support. And these are the people who probably listened to you from 2012 to 2019 about being like, yeah, Aaron, we know. Canned cocktails. Yeah, they're coming, bud. Okay, we got you.
Yeah. But you know, some people like really did come through. Mike Capifari at Thunderbolt was one of our first accounts. Keeper at Barkeeper. K&L picked us up right away. The boys at Estretto picked us up like right away, like reached out to me on that one. They're like, this is cool. Awesome. We want to carry it. Yeah, like that's sort of where it started. And I was constantly hitting people up. Liquor Fountain picked this up. I was like constantly just trying to sell, like sell, you know? And it's pretty intense, but we ended the year with about 120 accounts in SoCal. And then that was like a good base to start off 2021.
So the model is sort of like a record label, right? Where
exactly.
The artists get, or the bartenders, artists, bartenders get a royalty on the cans. How does the business work? Why was that important to you instead of just paying them for their IP up front and owning the masters, if you will?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted their success to grow with our success. Right. And we're actually looking at even changing the model we're doing now to give them more equity in the long-term success of the company rather than the per unit sales. But, you know, to me, it was like, if we make a drink and it only sells 10 cases, mm-hmm. then like that's what you make. But if it sells 100,000 cases, then you make something commensurate to that.
Yeah. I mean, it was important before. I think going back to your point about being like, I'm a bartender. I make money when I'm on my shift. If I'm not on my shift, I don't make money. Like the idea of working in service and having any sort of passive income was almost, it's still in many ways a novel idea. But even more so during the pandemic, being able to support the community by saying like, hey, like your shifts are down, or like the bar that you ran doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, or the place where you have debt piling up because you have rent and things like that. It's pretty amazing to see that as a business model for an industry that didn't even, I mean, forget canned cocktails, didn't have a way to support, which we saw really as like a huge issue at the start of March of 2020. How has the response been to that part of it? Like, do you have more people coming to you for being a part of this, or is there a waiting list, or like, you know, you're like, you know, how do you select who's coming next? Because I'm sure people are like, oh, I too want the prestige of having my own canned cocktail.
Right. I mean, there's a bit of an informal waiting list. We had, I had a lot of friends in the beginning who agreed to be a part, and I am still working on getting their drinks out. So we're just not, we haven't cleared the list, as it were, but we, you know, as the company grows and develops, you know, the thing about releasing a lot of different SKUs is that it's pretty cash intensive.
Yeah. I learned that from Shark Tank. Less SKUs is better.
Yeah. So, it's a challenge for sure. Right. So we're trying to like manage what we have on hand currently, and get a healthy cash flow.
So how do you grow? Because obviously I never really thought about the idea of scaling IP, which is obviously in music, like easy. Cause like, hey, here's the song. You can listen to this anywhere. But you know, shelf space, CPG, things like that. Like, what have you learned? What would you offer to people who are thinking about getting into this business? You know, like how do you go from Southern California to like a much more national or national scale?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a game of simultaneous efforts that you hope all line up together. And what I mean by that is like, let's say I pitched Hyatt Hotels.
Yeah.
And they're like, this is great. We want this everywhere.
Every mini bar, everything is stocked with this.
In every state. Right. And then you basically need to scramble to get distribution in every state, because for the most part, there are some companies that have multi-state properties, right? So like Southern Wine and Spirits covers almost every state. Breakthrough covers a good deal of them. RNDC covers a good deal of them. But like if Hyatt wants you, they want you. Ideally is, and you want to capitalize on the opportunity ASAP. So then you have to convince a distributor, hey, bring us on. This is worth your time. And this is worth the money up front that you're going to pay for the product.
Right. Cause you got to scale up the cans. You got to scale up the product in the cans. You got to get everything going.
That part's not that terribly difficult, right? Oh. Like,
well, there we go.
For us anyway, for you. Right? So, we designed our product so that we could essentially change the quantity. We could scale the quantity up basically overnight. It's a very scalable formula. So that's not super difficult. But what is difficult is like, again, getting the distributor to move fast and then also like get those deals. So that's really the way to scale, right? At the end of the day, the person who's buying for Hyatt is a person, right? Same as the person who's buying for Pink Elephant on the corner here, right? Like it's a person, and you need to convince that person, hey, you will be served well by carrying this.
Yeah.
So,
right.
It's like, I listened to this podcast, speaking of Shark Tank, there's this coffee company, like this iced can something coffee, super coffee, something like that.
Sure.
And like, you know, the owner or founder of the company said something along the lines of like, it takes, given it's a little choogy, but he was like, it takes the same amount of effort for a lion to hunt a mouse as it does a fucking antelope, but the mouse, you know, if he only eats mice, he'll die. Right. And so I was like, that's pretty smart. So I basically started attacking the chains more. And trying, because it's like you can scale up your sales that way with the same amount of effort.
Right. You're like, cool, like I still got to call the person, wherever that person is, to either stock me in a bar, or I call the person who runs all of the West Coast operations for Hyatt.
Right.
Got it.
And both are valuable, right? Like, of course, you want people to drink it in bars because people are much less price sensitive at a bar than they are at a store, typically, right? Like, you're in a bar and you're at a bar because you're ready to part ways with your $10+ for a drink.
Yeah.
You know, and like,
right.
You're just there to have a good time.
I'm here to have a good time. That time includes me opening my wallet and saying goodbye.
Right. Whereas at a store, like, the possibilities are endless, and it's, you know, you could walk out with nothing. Mm. I do that all the time. I go to liquor stores and just look and leave just because it's like interesting to me. But like, you can't do that at a bar. You're a sociopath if you go into a bar and just look around and leave.
Is that absolute? That's nice. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for answering my question.
That's it.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, not to bring it completely full circle, but you know, you started out making these high-end cocktails with Sasha, and in this like crazy time of like where everything is like made a la minute to the moment, things like that. And you've taken that foundation and you've put it into a can. Do those, I mean, the through line makes sense, but how do you think younger you would look at you now about being like, wow, are you not slapping basil 5 times in front of the customer to release the essence? You're just cracking a can?
It's funny. Sasha like gave me a couple of like awakenings / like come to Jesus moments, when gave younger me a lot of those moments, right?
Sure.
Like, you know, to him, it's real. As with any religion, it's always the disciples that fuck up the message, right? Mm-hmm. So like Sasha cared about giving people something that tasted good in a short period of time. And like, I can show you his like service manual if you've never seen it, but like, it was about service. It was about really good service and creating a really good experience. It wasn't about like being masturbatory to the guests or to anyone. Like, he'd never talked to the press, like to anyone about how much you put into your product, how much effort you put into your mojito. He taught us how to make it so that it would taste really good, but he never bragged about it, right? So younger me misinterpreting this message would have been like, yeah, fucking 2020 Polsky is a sellout. Like, that's gross. I can't, how could fresh juice ever taste good in the can? I would like to think that Sasha would have liked this, right? Where he would have been like, this is a really good cocktail that people can take anywhere, because like, you can't really do that with fresh juice drinks. But by the same token, he might have been like, this is fucking bullshit. I can't believe I know you.
Well, listen, Aaron, congratulations. If people want to find out more about Livewire, the drinks, the bartenders, or where they can get it, where can they go?
Yeah, give us a follow on Drink Livewire on Instagram. I also have a woefully bad TikTok that I'm trying to do stuff on, also Drink Livewire, and just go to drinklivewire.com to order our drinks online and learn more about them.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. Good to see you. I'm sure I'll see you in person very soon.
I'm outside your window.
You're outside my window right now. Yeah, that was, good to see you. Hair looks good against the backdrop of the Altadena Mountains.
Appreciate that.
We have another song from the archives and then a live performance from the archives here on heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm Chava Periban, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods that a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainably managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have the Rizzos live in studio. Welcome.
Hello. Hey.
Hello.
Would you like to go around the room and introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Megan.
I'm Justin.
And I'm Bettina.
Leaning on the drums.
Leaning on the drums to get closer to the microphone.
As drummers do.
The Rizzos are one of the hardest working bands in New York City.
Verified.
Verified. What sets you apart from the other 19 or so hardest working bands?
Ooh. We're the prettiest.
I mean,
I don't know if that's. I'm gonna be honest. I'm not sure.
We're probably
true.
The most iced band.
We're the most iced band.
Yeah.
We're sponsored by Smirnoff.
We're the
Ice.
Only King Pizza band on that hardest working list this year.
But there's a lot of hardworking King Pizza bands.
That's
there
true.
Are a lot of hardworking.
Do you feel like that poll is representative? It's a good. It's a real indication. Or do you think?
I was thinking about this yesterday, and because I felt like that might come up talking about this. And here is my stance, and you guys feel free to jump in.
Rev up for it.
I really was like preparing in the shower. So I think that since there are so many bands and so many shows, that their criteria makes a ton of sense for their publication. Like, and they have at the top of the list every year, they're like, these are the shows that we listed. We can only get to so many. So this is like our hardest working. And I think that's 100% valid and really fantastic. Mm-hmm. But I think there are so many smaller bands that are busting their asses. Sorry, butts. All the time.
It's a podcast. You can say asses.
That's true.
Yeah. Ass.
Sweet.
Well, they're busting it. That don't get... They don't play the right... Like, the bigger venues. They don't get the write-ups on certain blogs. But they're playing just as many shows, if not more. So I think there are different, like, levels of hardest working depending on
So there's a shadow hardest working. A secret hardest working, if you will.
Yeah, I would say so.
Probably and like a lot of people like also like that list just does not include like DIY venues and things that like they're not. There could be someone playing like 365 shows a year.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know about it.
Like we played a good number of basement shows and like house shows last year, which like those aren't going to get on there because no one wants their address on the internet.
And also, if we're honest, we're not really hardworking. We don't
that
really work
untrue.
Hard.
Speak for yourself, Justin. Mr. Late to everything.
I was kind of on time today.
I was unclear that house shows and DIY venues did not show up on that. I feel like that's a huge part of the scene that they're tracking.
I'm assuming they don't.
They didn't, no.
Not for the most part.
Yeah.
Because it's only, it's got to be, like, through, I don't know.
Yeah, but like I said, like, I think their criteria is super spot on, and I think there's a good and valid reason why these shows don't, like, the basement shows don't end up listed, because you don't really need that being blasted out that big, because the show will fit 30 people, and you're happy. But it definitely is missing a section of the, like, DIY scene, for sure.
Well, I also think a lot of bands get their footing in those venues too. I mean, even to get to somewhere like Alphaville or something along those lines, you have to play a number of house shows to even know what it is to get on stage.
Exactly. Totally.
I want to read something you sent to me about you. The Rizzos.
Ooh.
Their currency is laughter. Main export is good times. Their GDP is roughly that of a deserted island. Please tell me about your main export of good times.
Justin?
Well, you see, we don't import a lot except for beer, but because we import so much beer, we're just naturally always producing good times, at least for ourselves. I don't know how well-known we are in the international community yet for our export of good times, but we like to think that, I mean, it's really the only thing we got. We're not producing anything else.
To speak to our international Snacky Tunes community, what type of good times would you be bringing to them across the sea?
Well, hopefully they'll get a little bit of awkward dancing.
I was about to shout out our game.
What's our game?
Is on the count of three, do the ugliest dance you can think of.
Oh, yeah. And make the worst face possible. Mm-hmm. That's a good time.
Can we get a worst face? Can I say one, two, three?
Oh, I did the dance move, too. Oh, yeah. So weird. I don't know what that was. Zombie.
For the listeners at home, how ugly do you think that was?
I'm going to say Megan won.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Good job, Megan.
You threw in the wiggle. For those who can't see, you threw in a wiggle. Can we get a song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us first?
Do you want to do Bless This Mess?
Sure.
Let's do it.
Cool. This is a newish one.
Here we go.
You mentioned King Pizza Records earlier. King Pizza Records is a gang.
It is a
Whoa.
Gang.
You're not
just
wrong.
Like ICP.
Just like ICP.
we're officially recognized by the FBI.
Let's not tip them off, Justin.
Hey.
For the uninitiated, what is King Pizza Records and who makes up the gang?
Bettina, you take this one.
Oh, okay.
Are you fixing something?
Well, I'm trying to find the part of my... hi-hats I destroyed, but I'll do it in a second.
I'll take it. So King Pizza Records was started by our friend Greg Hansen. He plays drums in the Mad Doctors, among some other bands. He started it kind of as kind of like... basically, he wanted to be able to... As a true fan of music in Brooklyn and elsewhere, he was very concerned that all these awesome bands that he knew weren't really getting distribution or any sort of like label support. And so he wanted to put his own resources to helping other people release their music... digitally on tapes and on vinyl as well. And he also wanted to really like build and foster a community where, in addition for him like putting out music, he also wanted to create like a community that would like self-sustain and support itself and kind of be like an artist coalition of like, you know, if you're on the label, go see these awesome bands, support them, hype their stuff, listen to their stuff, spread it around, and really, you know, do it together sort of mentality.
And everyone's like very like-minded and like just really loves each other's music, and like I think we've all made like our best friends out of this group of people, just like who love being at shows, who love making music, who love listening to music. And yeah, the community is a really huge part of it.
Yeah, it's been great. So it started, I want to say like 2013 with four bands maybe, and now we have a roster of like 25 to 30 at any time, mostly in Brooklyn, also in like Philly, and I think
Austin.
OMAX are from Ohio, something like that.
Ohio,
so yeah, it's been really awesome. It's a ton of fun. Like everyone said, it's like good people hanging out, making music. And we try to be as inclusive and opening to people who like just want to come to shows as possible, because there's definitely that fear of like, what if I don't know anybody?
Yeah, so many people use the word community and then kind of fall short of it. What makes this community so unique?
I like... every King Pizza show, like, even if you don't know anyone, like, you walk into the room and I think you're going to leave, like, you're going to leave knowing people. Everyone just, like, wants to talk, wants to get to know everyone. Like, if you walked in by yourself, someone would probably walk up to you and be like, hey, what's up? Like, what's going on? What brought you here?
Yeah, like, if I can, like, share, like, a true experience of someone else. I was talking to Romy from Power Snap. Shout out. She was talking about, like, she's a relative. I think she's only been in Brooklyn for about, like, a year now. And she said she, like, came to a show. And then, like, because, like, I invited her or something. And then, like, she immediately got involved with, like, Seth and got involved with, like, working with people and, like, met a bunch of friends. And, yeah, it's just, like, cool. Like, we've made so many friends personally with, like, artists, photographers, musicians, and people just come. And I don't know. I think it's just, like, a very welcoming group of people that just want to have friends and have fun and support each other and, you know, help people's dreams come true.
Everyone's, like, super into side projects, too. Like, we have one good friend, Rachel Adler, who's a visual artist, and, like, she's like, I'm going to put together an exhibit at this show. So then, like, that's a big show. You'll have, like, an opening, and then her art's hanging up for, like, a couple months.
Yeah, she's doing, like a monthly thing at Footlight now, where she's just giving, you know, photos. She's, like, curating other people's art shows, and, like, with, like, music as well. It's really awesome.
Yeah, you mentioned Footlight, but what are some of the other venues that the shows take place at?
The Gutter's a big one.
Yeah, we've taken a hard hold of the Gutter recently, mostly because Greg books there, and it's because it's wonderful and always sounds good.
So much. And there's bowling.
Where do they set up the bands?
There's a back room if you walk through the bathrooms.
Oh, that's right. I always forget about that.
Pass the crapper and you'll find the music.
You'll find the crapper. No, just kidding.
I forgot. I saw White Lung there.
Oh, cool.
Forever
ago.
Yeah. That's right. Awesome. I always wanted them to set up on half of the lanes.
Dude, that would be amazing.
That is my dream.
That's the dream, right?
The opening scene of Josie and the Pussycats. They're playing on the bowling
lanes. They used to have the Asbury lanes in Asbury Park. I think that place has been closed for a while at this point.
I was talking to someone yesterday. They're reopening soon.
Yes. Woo.
Goals. We want to play there.
But I do know the Gutter had, they did cover bands on Halloween. They had some in the front room, which really shakes it up.
That's awesome.
Weird.
It's really interesting for this because it sounds like how when I went to basement shows growing up, it's the same thing where, like, you didn't know anybody, you would meet people. It's really awesome to hear in 2017, 2018, where people feel so isolated.
Yeah.
That there's a community like this that still exists, and then you can be a weirdo and go to a show and make friends, which is really what I always felt music and art did for people.
I agree. Totally. I think Greg has really, I interrupt you, I apologize. But he's collected all the weirdos. Like, he's collected a lot of weirdos that he knows.
There's more.
That's true. Please, if you want to come see Garage Rock, come to King Pizza, be weird with us.
King Pizza, most of the weirdos.
Yeah. I would call that an unofficial subtitle.
The cheesiest weirdos.
Whatever you want to call it.
Can we hear another song?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I hope you guys don't mind. My hi-hat is now a crash cymbal.
Sweet. Let's do Breslin, because that's what I'm tuned for.
Perfect. We'll be right back.
chair's really bouncy. I like it.
You should always play on bouncy chair.
Yeah. February 9th.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, oh, yeah. February 9th. You know where this is going.
I'm excited to talk about it.
Let's talk about it. Fourth annual Valentine's Day party.
Valentine's Day prom. Prom. In fact.
Yes. Well, prom is a party.
That is true. It's okay, you're right. You're
not,
totally correct.
Not all parties are proms, but all proms are parties.
Correct, yes. Probably. And now I'm feeling sad that not all parties are proms.
Oh, yeah, true. Okay, fine. Fourth annual.
Fourth annual.
Let's talk about it.
Yes.
All right. Give
us an origin story.
All right, so they're tuning, so I'm going to take this opportunity to talk about my favorite thing of the year, which is prom. We have a song called Prom Song, kind of a prom-y vibe. So 4 years ago, we were like, let's throw a Valentine's Day prom at Don Pedro, which is where we were playing a lot of shows and spending a lot of time. So it was we played there, like, I swear, once a week for 2 years, something like that. That was a casual exaggeration.
Did that get counted? Did Don Pedro get counted?
Some shows.
Inconsistent.
Yeah. Depending on the show.
We were a little baby band, so.
Yeah, we played anytime someone was like, we need a band. Rizzles will say yes. We're like, you're right. So we had the first prom there. Just kind of like, we'll throw a show. We'll see how it goes. Photo booth, prom king and queen. And dress it was, up. Yeah, dress up formal. And it was a blast. Like, it was so much fun.
Was it proper formal or was it like theme formal?
Theme formal, I would say.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, you could show up casual. We're not like strict about it.
Yeah, there are no rules.
Yeah, there's no rules. Yeah. Parents, no rules.
Yeah.
And no chaperones. We did it with our greatest homies, Sirs and Madams.
Mm-hmm.
They were our prom dates for our first year, our second year, and our third year.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not joining us this year because they recently split up.
They retired.
Makes us very sad. They retired.
Of us. Sick of us.
So yeah, we did the first one at Don Pedro. Mm-hmm. Where was the second
one? The last
one?
Two were at the gutter.
Last two both at the gutter.
Okay, and this one is going to be at the gutter as well because we love the gutter.
We do. And it has that disco ball and the fun twinkle lights. It just feels very prom-tastic.
Yeah. Is there prom dancing and bowling and everything?
We have yet to incorporate the bowling officially, but yeah. I do think we can consider that after prom, post-prom party.
That's always on the dock is.
You take your limo.
Yeah.
I'm just
kidding. And is it... Tell us about the lineup. It's a mix of live music and DJs?
So we're still starting out the details for a DJ, but I believe it's a member of World's Greatest Detective will be DJing.
He's going to be in between sets.
Yeah. And then, sorry guys, I'm talking so much. So if you want to jump in, please feel free.
We have Ghost Funk Orchestras joining us, which I'm super stoked about. The Royal They and Plaid Dracula. Yep. And then us.
Reverse order.
And if you've never been, what can you expect?
Expect the unexpected. No, it's, I mean, it's going to be one, a lot of great music. If I do say so myself, we did mm-hmm. a really good job picking awesome bands to play.
I agree.
There's going to be, we haven't hammered out all the details, but there's going to be definitely some fancy clothing and some dancing. There's going to be a prom king and queen, which we will vote on throughout the night ballot.
Yes.
There might be some campaigning. Some.
There might does be. Tend to be.
Has the campaigning unofficially started, or does it start the night of?
I bet it's going to start as soon as people hear this podcast. It's going to...
It should start the night of, for fairness.
Yeah.
But... Sure.
Technically, there shouldn't be any campaigning near the polling place, but...
It's within 20 feet.
It's a pretty small space, so we're going to have to...
Yeah.
I'm looking for a good fight.
But we also have a host, which is Coach Dave. He's mm-hmm. everyone's favorite gym teacher.
And chaperone.
And he's the only chaperone. Yeah. So he's always running around throughout the night, and he does intros for the bands and maybe some activities.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We had a scooter race last year, mm-hmm. which my team won. We won the relay.
Yeah.
Very impressive.
It's very fun.
I'm proud of you.
Have there been any romance stories from past proms?
None that we can tell.
We can't say.
Here. Okay.
But yes, there definitely have.
Okay. Over beers and pizza afterwards.
Yes.
That's fair. Absolutely.
I want to make sure we talk about what's coming up the rest of the year. You're going on a mini tour.
Yeah, we're working on it. Probably about 4 or 5 days at the end of April. Mm-hmm. We're going to do that. And then we're hoping to do a little bit longer of one, but we're still hammering out those details also.
And you have a release coming out too.
Yes. We are releasing a split 7-inch with our pals Top Notches from New Pulse. They're mm-hmm. amazing. We are happy to welcome them onto the label. And then once we do that, we're probably going to do like a summer tour or something with them. We haven't
amazing.
Figured it out.
And this all might be timed with Pizza Fest 5.
That's the goal. The goal is to have the 7-inch at Pizza Fest 5, which is going to be in May. That depends on, pressing vinyl casual. I'm very excited we're going to be on vinyl. But Pizza Fest 5 should be fantastic, and hopefully our yeah, hopefully our release is then.
Yeah, the biggest pizza part of the year. That's like, that's peak King Pizza Records right there.
Yeah, three days, lots of bands, lots of actual pizza.
Yeah, who are the are there actual vendors? Is it bring your own slice? What's the deal?
We usually have vendors and we sell pizza. So we will provide the pizza. Last year we worked with Sizzle Pie.
Delicious.
We've worked with Vinny's in the past, so that's all still being hammered out. But it will be tasty.
Cool.
And possibly vegan. I love Sizzle Pie.
It can possibly be vegan for you.
So excited.
Justin is now vegan, so.
Vegan pizza has come a long way.
Yeah.
The first slice I had was maybe 14 years ago in Eugene, Oregon, and it was garbage. it actually undid the statement that any pizza is good pizza. This is terrible.
Oh, no.
But it's really come a long way.
Did they do the thing where they tried to put fake cheese on it?
Yeah, that was the problem. That was the problem.
You can do it.
Just do some. Sometimes now.
It's better now, but this was like the cashew cheese type thing. You're like, just give me a tomato pie.
Yeah.
Give me a gluten-free tomato pie. We're cool.
Yeah. See, fake cheese has come a long way, but I can imagine back then it was like just really unfortunate.
Pioneers. last question.
Oh, Oregon Trail joke.
There it is.
Died of dysentery and got pizza.
If the Rizzos were any type of food or dish, what would you be?
We did discuss this a little bit, and we think that we might be our classic tour sandwich.
Yeah, we're a sandwich.
We were a sandwich. Bettina loves sandwiches.
I feel very strongly about them. It's true.
And we feel so strongly we have an ongoing roundtable discussion with our pals Heavy Flow from New Jersey about what is a sandwich
is
and the nonsense that can be called a sandwich nowadays.
Yes.
Hot dog, not a sandwich.
I'm very angry about it.
Is there any particular type of sandwich?
Hot dogs are not sandwiches.
No, Justin, tour sandwich.
I said I was angry.
The Rizzo sandwich.
When we were on the road, we stopped at Target and we got a cooler and we just like got a bunch of ingredients to make sandwiches. So it's like a Martin's potato roll.
Wow, so good.
Some veganaise for the vegans. Avocado, tomato, and cheese if you can eat cheese.
Did we put spinach on the last?
We did put spinach on it.
Yeah.
Really good.
And my thought process.
Next time we should add some mustard, maybe.
Oh, getting fancy. My thought process is like it's quick, easy, satisfying, and you can have it in the back of a car.
You can make it in the back of a car.
Hey.
Sorry.
Where can people find you, find your music, find your tour dates, learn about King Pizza Records?
They can find our music at therizzos.bandcamp.com. We're also on Spotify and Apple Music and all that jazz.
We got a Facebook page where that's where basically all of our updates go, events, tour announcements. We have like a Twitter and an Instagram, but we're not so good at it.
Yeah, we're not the best.
We only use Twitter when we're on tour.
Yeah.
We're like and trying we're to embarrass Betty on the internet.
It's real. And King Pizza's best on Facebook, for sure.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah. This has been great.
What's the name of the last song you're going to play for us?
It's Way Out.
Way Out. Well, thanks for tuning in for another episode of Snacky Tunes. We will be back next week. We'll see you then. Take us out. We'll be right back.
about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.